Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What makes Afghanistan the complex, fascinating, and sometimes deeply troubled place that it is today? Certainly, a two-century history of sporadic foreign occupation has been a complicating factor in the country's development. But contrary to perceptions of some in the West, my guest this hour will tell us that Afghanistan's rich history has been punctuated but never defined by the outsiders. And the outsiders have, despite the fact that outsiders have tried to enforce their own wills on the country. Author Tamim Ansari explains in his new book, Games Without Rules, The Often Interrupted History of Afghanistan. Tamim, welcome back to Think.
Oh, thank you very much.
The book is such an interesting reminder that we think we know about Afghanistan based on what we hear in the news and have for years or for decades, but those headlines are really just a small part of the story. Obviously, you know this place well. It's where you were born. But talk about what made you want to ground all that daily news in a wider perspective for readers.
Well, I guess it's just that I myself read the news, you know, and I find that if all I knew about Afghanistan was the news I was reading in my paper, it would be suicide bombing, NATO accidentally bombing children, suicide bombing. And I know that there's a lot more going on in Afghanistan. And then also, you know, growing up in Afghanistan, I was imbued with the narrative of Afghan history, as I think, you know, any American growing up in the United States would be imbued with that sense of the Revolutionary War, the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln, the great figures of history. And I know the Afghan side, the Afghan narrative in that same way. And I've always just thought that that narrative is so gripping, so full of compelling character, so full of drama, and I just wanted to tell that story.
One of the things you do in the book is sort of weave in bits from your own family's fascinating history. From you had a distant relative who was a poet, and the story of how your grandparents came together is really interesting. Did you, I mean, were you sort of consciously looking for, okay, how does the stories I was told for years and years as a kid, how does all that jibe with actual history?
Well, I wasn't looking for it, but I kept stumbling across it. You know, in a way, I knew that our family was, elsewhere I have described us as the Zelligs of Afghan history. You know, we're sort of always, when something big happens, one of us seems to be right there in the background as a shadowy figure. So I was aware that, for example, you know, my uncle was one of the 18 cadets who were in the military school when this bandit came to attack Kabul and they held him off for a day. And in the course of researching the story, I discovered even more things. My father, you know, his peripheral involvement in the turmoil of the 60s, and so on. So my family has been interlaced with the history in a small way. We weren't shaking moving figures, but we were always there.
One problem with the narrowness of a lot of the reporting on Afghanistan is that it seems to leave out how much diversity exists within the country. And sometimes that diversity means conflict, but there's diversity of culture and of politics and of economic circumstances. Has that always been the case?
Well, the diversity has always been the case. It's a clamorously diverse country simply because it consists of the residue of all the different people who have crossed that territory and left behind, you know, some people. And the Afghans are, in fact, pretty much the descendants of all the people who have conquered Afghanistan. So I would say conquering Afghanistan is not actually impossible, but it's been very problematic in the last 2.5 centuries.
So let's talk a little bit about the title of the book. As various interests have gained power in Afghanistan over time, they've essentially come up against other influences, those who came before, those who simply were there. So that as you write, that sort of the games get intertwined, and then the rules become irrelevant, and then there are no rules.
Well, yeah, and you know, the phrase that we most often hear in connection with Afghanistan is the great game. Mm-hmm. And the great game was supposed to be the jockeying between the British Empire and the expanding Russian Empire, with Afghanistan as the line of scrimmage, each one trying to hold that territory in order to block the advance of the other. So that was the great game. And what occurred to me was that in Afghanistan, say 2.5 centuries ago, around the time that the country was first forming, what was the society like? It wasn't actually a society that was governed by any central government. It was, you know, sort of grassroots leadership from the village and local level. And who were these leaders? They were not appointed. They were not elected. They just kind of emerged. And who, you know, gave the rules? Who imposed rules? Who wrote them? Well, that was just sort of understood among the people because they had this idea about Islam and the Sharia, and that was all mixed in with customs and folkways. And that was, you know, the governing principles of life. And I was reminded of the game of buskashi, which is an equestrian sport, and mounted riders grab a goat carcass off the ground and try to get it to a certain goalpost. And what struck me was the game is very well understood, but it has no set size of field, no set number of players, no teams, no referees, and yet people have been playing it for centuries, and they just understand, you know, what the game is about. So there was that game, and then Afghan history has been the attempt by various, you know, elites and leaders to impose some kind of framework on that game, to turn, you might say, buskashi into football, so that it could be governed, controlled, and operated from some central point.
Well, you know, Tamim, the other great thing about the buskashi metaphor is that it's a game that is, as you say, well understood by people who have watched it, who are familiar with it. On the other hand, to outsiders, it sounds very difficult to understand.
To outsiders, it might look like just a chaotic melee of drivers, I mean, of horsemen
riders, yeah,
just clashing. And I made that Freudian slip about drivers because when I was in Kabul this April, the traffic on the streets reminded me of buskashi. And I anybody who has any sense of rules of the road would not survive half an hour on the streets of Kabul driving a car. But Afghans, they manage it somehow.
Missing only the goat carcass, I guess, when you were driving
yeah,
through the streets. You hadn't been back home in some time before this last visit, is that right?
Yeah, I hadn't, but this last visit was last spring, and then before that I went right after the Taliban were ousted in 2002, and then before that I hadn't been there since I was 16 and left the country to come to school here.
What are you able to notice with those gaps in time that people who are living their day-to-day might not notice, and people who sort of visit more regularly might also take for granted?
Well, you know, I think it's striking that I noticed a lot more difference in some deep way between Afghanistan in 2012 and Afghanistan in 2002 than I did in Afghanistan 2002 compared to when I left, which was 1963. That period of all the war and carnage, although it's true that damaged the social fabric in really deep ways, but what was visible to me was material destruction. The buildings were all reduced to rubble. And in that rubble, the Afghans were living a life that seemed familiar to me. You know, I felt like I could just mingle with Afghans. We'd have that same sort of timeless, slow sense of negotiation socially with nobody particularly caring about what it was we were all trying to get done. That was the Afghan feeling. And now, 10 years later, I go there, and it's just so busy, hard-charging, everybody's on the make, the money is pouring in from someplace, nobody knows from where, but it's important to try to get next to it so you can get some. There is such a dramatic sort of contrast between the wealth and the poverty. You know, it's like you have mansions and then you have two families living in a metal box right next door to a mansion. It's very striking, and it's very vigorous.
The book also sort of delves into the contrasting influences within the country of rural and urban and modern and traditional. Talk about those a little bit.
Well, the rural I think of as the original Afghanistan, you know. And Afghanistan had been for centuries a place where people made their living as herders, farmers, and, you know, some of them were nomads, so they were herders. They lived this life that was dominated by several factors, one of which was the division of the world into public and private. You know, the private world was the one that men and women occupied. The public world was only men. There was a sense of the walled village, the outsiders, the insiders. and a slow pace of life. And in the cities over these past two centuries, and probably in large part because of the presence and encroachment of these immense powers from the West, the cities began to be interested in, one, adopting the culture of the West, and B, finding a way to control and shape the life of the rurals. Hmm. And that's been the dynamic or dialectic of Afghan culture and Afghan history over the past, two centuries, but so much in the past century. And I think, people on the outside in recent times might have a picture of Afghanistan as a place that's all 12th century guys with beards, that stuff. And yet, in fact, it's had a very sort of urban, busy, vigorous, commercial, even in some sense, secular life in the cities. When I say secular, I don't mean that the people are in any sense self-defined as not being Muslims. They do think of themselves totally as Muslims, but they're busy with a life that's governed by something other than religion, and that's the urban world. So that's been the struggle.
What changed in Afghanistan? First of all, you described sort of traditional life, but what was life like when the place that is now Afghanistan had not yet been founded as an Afghan state?
Well, in that area, from time to time, there would arise a conqueror of some kind. In other words, somebody with vigorous ambitions and a military caste and a charismatic sort of ability to rally tribal armies. And when that happened, he'd go out and conquer stuff as far as he could. And the conquest was all about kind of about plundering, kind of about being able to impose taxes on various places, and kind of about being able to draft more people so you could extend those conquests. And I would say that in the daily lives of most people, whoever was the supposed king, it didn't make much difference. They just lived their life the way they were living it. I also just want to throw in there, however, that we think of Afghanistan as being very tribal. That's what you always hear. Oh, it's a very tribal country. And actually, tribalism is really characteristic of only one of the ethnic groups, that's the Pashtuns, and half of them live in Pakistan. And then there's other major ethnic groups, the Tajiks, not very tribal at all, and very much given to commerce, and they live in the cities. And then there's the Uzbeks, that's a whole different thing. So the different groups are not necessarily organized as tribes, or they don't think of themselves as tribes. And yet there has been sort of a homogeneous sense of a cultural milieu that has pervaded Afghanistan in such a way that if you traveled across that area, I think you would find yourself on familiar ground, or you would have found yourself on familiar ground, whether you were in Mazar-e-Sharif in the north or, someplace down in the south.
My guest is author Tamim Ansari. His new book is called Games Without Rules, The Often Interrupted History of Afghanistan. If you'd like to join us with a question or a comment, we invite you to do so now at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to the show to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Investing in your education can pay big dividends. SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning could help. You can earn a CFP certificate at SMU starting in January. Details online at cfp.smu.edu.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Tamim Ansari. His new book is called Games Without Rules, The Often Interrupted History of Afghanistan. If you'd like to ask a question or be part of the conversation, give us a call. The number is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@kera.org. So, Tamim, even if, even historically, not all of Afghanistan has been as tribal as some Westerners might have imagined. There were those and are different ethnic identities. How did that play into the ease or difficulty with which the country was sort of united under a single national identity?
Well, the supposed founder of Afghanistan, this warrior named Ahmad Shah Baba, he did his conquering with armies composed of people he had drafted from all the different ethnic groups. And some say that when those guys were serving in his armies, and by serving in his armies, what that really meant is it was a career move. They were in a position to share the plunders and the spoils of victory. So that was an inclusive sort of a thing. And in those armies, rubbing up shoulder to shoulder, people began to develop a sense of Afghanness. And there was this idea then that an Afghanistan existed. But over the next two centuries, the family and tribe of that original founder were definitely the dominating elite of Afghan society. There was an aristocracy and there was a monarchy. And it was also the case that the other ethnic groups had a certain amount of identification as having some particular role in society. And so the Tajiks were often considered, you know, the administrators, the bureaucrats, the kings administered through them. And there was another ethnic group, the Hazaras, who were at one time pretty much an autonomous nation within the borders, and then they were conquered, and then for a long time, they were the underdogs of Afghan society. And so these stratifications ethnically existed. I can say that for 40, 50 years, even 60 years before the apple cart was overturned by the Soviet invasion, despite these stratifications, there was kind of an accommodation and a stability and a certain amount of peace in Afghan society. The Hazaras were, for example, the underdogs. When they came to the cities, they had the scut work jobs, but they also had still their area where they lived. They had their villages, their tribal chiefs. There was still a certain amount of autonomy out there for them under the Afghan government. And that also held across the country.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak on the phone with Robert in Dallas. Hi, Robert.
Hi. Love this topic. I think it's really great and pertinent. I had just a quick comment. Having spent my entire life in U.S. education system and public school, it's so hard not to imagine a stereotypical Native American culture that when the word tribe is used so frequently with kind of Afghan ethnic groups. And I'm wondering what the author kind of has to, what comment about that, that it's hard not to think of this really kind of antiquated society that has no technology and, you know, chiefs and things, and because it's really not like that.
I'm interested that you bring that up. Yeah, I take your point. You know, I think tribal immediately conjures up a certain way of dressing, a certain way of acting, all these things. And I think I've mentioned in my book that, you know, tribal doesn't mean you're not wearing a punk outfit and playing, you know, hard, heavy metal rock, because I know people who are Afghans who do that now, and if you ask what is your tribe, they would know. Mm-hmm. So they belong to a tribe, but it doesn't actually necessarily relate to anything about their lifestyle. So enough said about that.
We know that the reach of British imperial ambition went far and wide, but what made Afghanistan so particularly attractive to the British Empire?
Well, I think it wasn't attractive to them. They were only occupying it so that the Russians wouldn't occupy it. And nobody was particularly attracted to Afghanistan. They didn't want anything that was there. It's just that Afghanistan had been, for centuries, the platform from which invasions of India were launched. So the British felt that if the Russians occupied that, they would be after Britain, after India next. And Russia had some interest in occupying that because that was their route to a seaport, and Russia did not have a seaport, not a good one. And in that era, 19th century, world power was completely linked in with access to the oceans, and that's what made Britain so dominant. Mm-hmm. So the Russians wanted that, and the British felt threatened. They tried to hold the line north of Afghanistan.
What has made it so challenging? As you've mentioned, it's not that Afghanistan has never been conquered, but it has been difficult, certainly in recent history. What do you think plays into the fact that lots of people have tried and very few have succeeded in sort of achieving everything they wanted by coming in from the outside?
Well, it is true that the terrain is difficult and armies have faced those difficulties. And, people have said the great Alexander the Great had trouble conquering Afghanistan. They're right. It took him 2 years. We've been there how long now? 12. Mm-hmm. So, but I think in recent times, the Western attempts to intervene in Afghanistan, the idea has been to control Afghanistan for some purpose that relates to a global game. And in order to do that, the foreign power has to have a country that operates as a country. That's the problem. And Afghanistan, whenever it is intervened upon, has the semblance of a country. It looks like a country.
Mm-hmm.
And the foreign power comes and they pluck out the perhaps rebellious existing leader, and they stick another guy in there and they say, this is your leader now. And Afghans just fragment in the face of that. So suddenly what they have is not a country but an ungovernable territory.
So, in other words, a group of little sort of pockets, regions, where things are run in different ways.
Yeah, and I would say that if there is anything that's characteristic of Afghan society in general, it's that perhaps in some sense every man thinks he should be the king. So, I remember years ago my cousin said, when it was the late days of the monarchy, well, these guys have been kings for so long that people kind of accept and say, okay, that family, I guess they're kings. But if they're ever ousted, then you're going to see chaos, because every single person is going to say, why should this next guy be the king and not me? And in fact, essentially, something like that did happen.
Did the arrival of, say, the British in particular, who sort of kept to themselves in some ways, they weren't trying to culturally colonize Afghanistan, but did, as they came in and brought possessions that maybe typical Afghans hadn't had before and ways of living, did that change the way Afghans thought about their own lives and their own sort of ambitions?
I think the British did not have much effect in that way, because they brought things and they used them in the compounds where they lived,
mm-hmm.
So that didn't get out into Afghan society very much. I think eventually there were things there were Western material items that made their way into Afghan culture, not directly from Britain, but because British India was next door and Afghans would go there and
yeah.
They'd bring stuff back. So that happened. It wasn't until really the 20th century that the Afghan urban elite became specifically interested in bringing in things from the West. I mean, things like, not just telephones, which they brought, and cars, which they brought, but also ideas like constitutions and ideas like science and, modern medicine, vaccines instead of snake charmers to heal your ills. So that began in the 20th century, and it began because Afghanistan had sufficiently a sovereign, stable state that an elite could develop, which was interested in what the outside world had to offer without necessarily being threatened by it.
And I guess one of the ways that those outside ideas were brought in was by sending the best and brightest from Afghanistan to be educated, at least in part, overseas.
That's certainly what began in the 1920s, and then it went on in the 30s. As I tell this whole dramatic story in my book about the radical king Amanullah,
mm-hmm.
He came to power in 1919. He declared the independence of the country, and then he just set about producing these reforms or trying to legislate these reforms, changing the status of women, building secular schools, all these things. And part of his idea was send kids abroad, have them study in Western universities, and bring them back, and then they will be able to develop the country. Well, he was overthrown. But the next dynasty that came in, they saw the wisdom in that, and so they started doing it. And one of the people they sent abroad in those early years was my uncle, and another one soon after that was my father. So these guys went abroad, and they not only acquired certain technical skills, which the government was interested in, but they also were exposed to other attitudes and other ideas, and they brought that back too.
So how did that play out in your father's career and in the way that you lived in Afghanistan when you were a young child? Tamim, are you with us? Okay, we somehow are having trouble hearing Tamim Ansari. We will call him back in just a moment. 1-800-933-5372 is the telephone number. If you've got a question to ask, maybe you want to make a comment, perhaps you've traveled in Afghanistan. We're talking this hour to Tamim Ansari about his new book, Games Without Rules, The Often Interrupted History of Afghanistan. Not quite sure what happened technically there with our telephone lines, but we are making every effort to bring him back on the phone quickly here. We're speaking, the book is very interesting because it's not only a history of Afghanistan, but also a story, in some cases, of Ansari's own family. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Once again, if you've got a question or want to make a comment, you can also send email to think@kera.org. Tamim, we have you back on the line with us?
Yes, you do.
Wonderful. Okay, great. I was asking about, you know, you mentioned that your father and your uncle went overseas for their education, and then that had an impact certainly on the life that your father and your mother had and the childhood that you had in Afghanistan. Talk about that.
Well, for one thing, when my father went abroad, he married my mother, and she was an American woman, the daughter of Finnish immigrants. So she was the first American woman to come back and live in the country with her husband. And that was sort of a pioneering, trailblazing move. And after that, some of the other students that were sent abroad also brought back American wives. There began to be foreign women in Afghanistan. For me, I was raised in a context in which outside of my family, my large clan sort of environment, I was seen as an oddity. You know, I was the first Afghan American. And so I experienced from early childhood a sense of being in two worlds at once. Inside my own family house, I was really, to some extent, an American, and out in the world, I was an Afghan. More and more people like me began to, you know, develop in Afghanistan. There was a community of Afghan Americans. And then, you know, other Afghans came back from abroad. They married Afghan wives, but the culture of urban sort of modernity grew and spread throughout the country, or throughout the cities of the country.
And you were educated in Afghan schools, is that right?
I was. I had a sort of a motley education. You know, I went to an Afghan elementary school for 3 years in my own in Kabul. Then I was kind of homeschooled for a while because we moved to a town where there were no real schools, the town of Lashkargah, which was not even hardly a town at that point, but now it's the capital of the Talibanist insurgency. Mm-hmm. Then they built schools there, and so I went to those schools. Those were government schools. I went to schools in which the language was the language of the region, which was Pashto, which I didn't speak. So I had to be heavily tutored in Pashto while I was also trying to keep up in geometry and geography in this other language.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Thomas in Dallas. Hi, Thomas.
Yeah, I was under the impression that when India and Pakistan broke up, that the Pakistanis wanted to unite under the Afghan king, which would have made the Pashtun people the most populous people in that nation, which, of course, they enjoyed no political representation. I was just wondering if you could elaborate on that history.
Well, there was a complication in that period when Pakistan was breaking off. That's true. There are a lot of Pakistanis who are not Pashtuns, so I don't think it's the case that all of the the breakaway Muslims of the subcontinent wanted to be part of Afghanistan. And it's not even clear that the Pashtuns wanted to be part of Afghanistan. There was a movement to found a country that would be only Pashtuns, and it would take part of Afghanistan and part of Pakistan, and there would be a new country there. And that's sort of the shadow dream of a country that has never quite died. It's always been a complicating factor in the politics. Afghanistan also was interested in getting the Pashtuns of Pakistan to be absorbed into their state, or to have a separate state that would be friendly to the Afghan royal monarchy. In the plebiscite that was held at that time, the people of the Pashtun area were given the choice of joining Pakistan or India. It was a very odd choice. Afghanistan was not on the table as a possibility.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Megan in Denton. Hi, Megan.
Hi. Thanks for having me, and
sure.
Thanks for being on the show. I studied art history at University of North Texas under Dr. Shaboot this past semester, and we discussed contemporary art of the Middle East. And, of course, it brought up the question about women in veils and Western, you know, trying to unveil the women over there. And so I'm just wondering, based on your opinion and your, I guess, interactions with that, what is the consensus over there about Western involvement with that?
Is there a consensus? Thanks for your call.
Right. I think there's not a consensus. You know, Afghanistan is a clamorously divided nation, and there is a urban demographic that definitely favors strongly the unveiling of women. And in the urban world of Afghanistan, there are feminists, you know, there are women who are very active, and they're trying to push this agenda. And then out in the countryside, it's hard to say what the women out there want, because nobody talks to them. No, you hear a lot about what Afghan women, you know, what should be done for them, but you hear that mostly from outside sources and then from the few voices that come from the cities. It's very difficult to go to the villages and get the opinions of the women there, because it's a sequestered world and the men won't let you in. So
my guest is author Tamim Ansari. His new book is called Games Without Rules, The Often Interrupted History of Afghanistan. Back in a moment, our number 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Investing in your education can pay big dividends. SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning could help. You can earn a CFP certificate at SMU starting in January. Details online at cfp.smu.edu.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author Tamim Ansari about his book, Games Without Rules, The Often Interrupted History of Afghanistan. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Tamim, to what extent did the Soviet occupation change the trajectory of Afghanistan and what came after, even after the Soviets left?
Well, I think the Soviet invasion was the decisive cutting point of the trajectory of Afghan history. It was the most catastrophic thing, I think, that has happened in this area maybe since Genghis Khan came through. The crux of it was that in the course of trying to subdue Afghanistan, the Soviets decided that the strength of the opposition lay in the existence of villages that the guerrillas could get shelter from and could get support from, and that the only way to win this war was to get rid of the villagers, to depopulate rural Afghanistan. And so the campaign aimed at that. There was carpet bombing, and they used mines, and they also shot the herds and tried to withhold from the population the means of survival. And so people did all there was left to do. They fled the country and ended up in refugee camps in Pakistan and in Iran. But even in some ways more devastatingly, the men didn't go there with the women, or at least they parked the women and the children, and they came back into the country. So the fabric of all Afghan society was sort of ripped in that process, and Afghanistan then was largely inhabited by roaming bands of warrior men who were cut off from families and just lived with other guys, and their whole occupation was war. And out in the refugee camps, squalid poverty, people living in conditions where the host country controlled their whole lives, and then they were subject to the propaganda and influence peddling and depredations of Islamist missionary sort of activists from the Arab world, and everything changed after that. The old Afghanistan sort of wasn't the same after that.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Andrew in Plano. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Chris. Great show. Tamim, because of your background, your culture, and understanding of the Afghan situation, in your opinion, what should be done in Afghanistan? Should the West, should we just leave and leave everybody alone? And if so, what would happen? And would the Afghani people be okay with it?
You know, I have to say that I think the West should not just leave and leave everyone alone, because that's one of the propositions that one hears. And everybody did that in 1990, and Afghanistan erupted into a civil war that really devastated the society. And that would happen again, perhaps, but the other thing that would happen, that might happen, is that all the other powers that are hovering nearby are going to push in. And that's going to produce some major blowback, not just for Afghanistan, but perhaps for larger global politics and perhaps for the U.S. as well. I mean, Iran is ready to go in. China's ready. India, even Russia is a factor again in there. So I think, you know, the military footprint that America has there has to lift, because that's not doing any good. You know, there's the surge in the 100,000 troops dispersed around the country. It's not doing any good because the problem in Afghanistan is ideological, cultural. It's not military. And I think support of some kind should continue to come from the West. But I think what's also really important is that people who go there should have a greater understanding of Afghan culture than people do in this period, or have in this recent period, you know, I think the salvation, the real bright point for Afghanistan, is the emergence of media, a free media, even a crusading sort of news media there, and the proliferation of technology with cell phones, TV, radio, and other sorts of communication things that is enabling people in remote areas to have contact and access and exposure to other cultural ideas than what prevails in their little valley. So I think out of that something may come, and the U.S. and Western help is needed to keep that going.
What do Afghan leaders have to do to gain the confidence, and I'm talking about in this era, to gain the confidence of the people they govern?
Well, you know, first we have to grapple with the idea of who are the Afghan leaders, you know.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that has been problematic is that I think there's two systems of leadership here, and one is the leaders who emerge in the old Afghan politicking way, with building networks of personal loyalty and service and mutual obligations. And then there's this other system which the West brought, and it's people vote for candidates, and then there's a parliament. And, you know, the real question is the parliament the government of the country, and is the presidency the leader, you know, is the president the leader of the country, or are those just apparatuses? I don't know what the plural of that is. Is all that just a mechanism whereby Afghans can get close to the foreign money that's coming into the country? I think that's kind of more what it has been. So the legitimacy of the mechanisms of government have to take hold in Afghan society. And I think, for one thing, that's going to just take some time. Sticking with the course is going to help with that.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Matthew is on the line now in Kapel. Hey, Matthew.
Hi. Thanks for your show. What a fantastic guest you got. My question was if you could speak briefly about the impact of the resources in Afghanistan. In other words, the Soviet Union invaded and tried to occupy, and now we find ourselves following their suit, and the amount of money, blood, and treasure that's been spent in what would appear to be nation building in Afghanistan. I'm wondering if that isn't just a guise for industry and other interests like the oil industry to capitalize and capture the resources of the country. It would seem that there's some geopolitics relating to oil that aren't being talked about. Could you speak to that?
Thanks for your call.
Well, you know, if we're there for the resources, we're doing a miserable job of it because China has secured the rights to Afghanistan's copper. Consortium of Indian companies has got the rights to Afghanistan's iron. Those are the two big types of resources that the minerals that Afghanistan has. And China, Chinese companies, private companies, have formed partnerships with Afghan companies to get control of the gas and oil.
Mm-hmm.
So we're over there fighting. These other countries are signing contracts, and they've got most of that. The rare earth minerals are the most glamorous minerals that Afghanistan has. They're a collection of minerals that are vital to solar technology and pretty much all green technology, and cell phones and computers use those things. So those are important minerals, but so far that hasn't been, I don't think anyone's really got that. I don't think that the situation in Afghanistan was about getting the minerals of Afghanistan. That's sort of there in the background. There may have been the fact that huge oil deposits exist in the area north of Afghanistan, and that the only way for the developed Western world to access that is through a pipeline, and the fact that the most viable route for that pipeline probably lay through Afghanistan, that may have, probably did in fact, have an effect on on the U.S. wanting to stabilize Afghanistan and make it safe for business, for oil business in particular. But I think that was more in play when the Taliban first came around. That's why the Taliban were tolerated for such a long time, and that's why the U.S. kind of turned a blind eye to Pakistan creating this group and helping them take over Afghanistan, because the idea was, well, at least they'll stabilize the place.
It does make me think about, Mexico ultimately, having had a lot of foreign interests sort of running its petroleum industry, and then ultimately deciding to nationalize, at least for several decades, and eject foreign entities that had been earning a great deal of the profits from that country's natural resources. Do you foresee the possibility that Afghanistan might do something like that? And if so, do you think it would be effective in keeping some of that wealth where it could really benefit the Afghan people?
Well, you know, there are two questions in there. One is nationalizing or having the nation state of Afghanistan take control of its own resources in the face of foreign powers. And the other is, within Afghanistan, who is going to control the resources if it belongs to Afghans? Because
yeah,
the social institutions of Afghanistan are not at the place now where there's any possibility for those resources to broadly benefit the Afghan people if Afghans control it. I think that would be one problem there. The other is that I think it's going to be a long time before Afghanistan has sufficiently an autonomous and powerful and sovereign country to be able to nationalize its resources in the face of powers such as China and India and all the rest of us. I think that would depend on outside powers coming to some kind of an agreement with each other, with one another, to regard Afghanistan as a no-touch zone or something like that.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Ijaz on the line in Plano. Hi, Ijaz.
Hi, Chris. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to have the question for Mr. Ansari. is a point that was made earlier in the program regarding the coverage of Afghanistan on the media here.
Yeah.
Where we hear mostly about the war and the and showing villages and suicide bombers and so forth. My question to you, Mr. Ansari, is this, that in your last visit to Afghanistan, did you have an opportunity to meet with people in the academic arena, professors and so forth, or executives of companies who have a different view of where Afghanistan is going or what Afghanistan is versus what we see here on the media?
Well, I did not meet directly with professors. I was on the university campus, and Kabul University campus, and I visited their library and talked to the people who ran the library. But I'm completely with you on the idea that there's there are many things going on in Afghanistan that are not the war per se, and you know, I will mention that. There are art galleries in Afghanistan. There are, publishing houses in Afghanistan. There's music happening in Afghanistan. There's theater. So there's quite a bit other than those few things we hear about. And, you know, I kind of try to keep track of Afghanistan news on a daily basis with some listservs that I'm on. And sometimes I lose it for, you know, weeks at a time. And my eerie experience is I come back and it feels like the news hasn't changed. Nothing's happened. It's still, you know, almost exactly the same news a month later. And really, that's not the news. That's only the most sensational things that are happening there.
So how optimistic are you about the future of Afghanistan, given what you know at this moment, both from sort of Western news accounts and from things that you're learning from within the region itself?
Well, you know, I think that I would have to characterize my position as optimistic in the end, which doesn't mean that I don't see some terrible hard times perhaps coming. But since most people I talk to only see that, I'd say the fact that I think it might there might be better times ahead is an optimistic sort of a view. I know that my feeling when I was in Kabul this time in Kabul was that the country is really tense and that people are very nervous about what's going to happen after 2014.
Yeah.
And at the same time, they're wanting to get to that period. You know, they're mustering and they're getting ready. And I asked somebody, do you think it's going to be that civil war again, which really just ripped that city apart in the 1990s? It was one of the really most horrible moments of that whole three-decade debacle. And, this guy said, no, I think people have learned their lesson from that time. There's going to be fighting, but it's not going to be like that. So that was just one guy's opinion, but I don't know.
It's a nice one to end on, certainly.
Yeah, thank you.
The new book by Tamim Ansari is called Games Without Rules, The Often Interrupted History of Afghanistan. Tamim, it's been a fascinating hour. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. You can download the podcast free at kera.org/think, and you can email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.